Welcome to Gerstl's Making Labs Work podcast, the show about analytical chemistry, interesting instruments, and the challenging analytical problems that they solve.
Welcome to this new episode of the Making Labs Work podcast here at Gerstl. Together with me, of course, is Kurt Sexton, my colleague from the US. Hello, Kurt.
Hi, Jan. Good to be back again.
Yes, a long time ago. And today our special guest is Mark Bücking from the Fraunhofer Institute in Germany, in the Sauerland, I would say in English. I don't know how to pronounce it in English, but welcome, Mark, at this point. And who are you and what are you doing?
Actually, I'm a young being working with Fraunhofer for the last 15 years. By training, I'm a food chemist. And specialized in trace analysis. So wherever they are volatile or non-volatile, and our institute actually is involved in substance-based ecology experiments, where we look into soil and water, and of course this ends up somewhere in feed and food. So that's the reason why I'm heading a department which is specialized to this trace analysis as well as to environmental monitoring.
Okay, and how do you pronounce the Sauerland in English from your side? Because you are sitting, I would say, 200 kilometers away from our headquarters here. But I say in German Sauerland, but I think it's Sauerland. How do you pronounce it when you meet your colleagues?
really not sure. I say 100 kilometers to the east from looking from a Cologne point of view.
Okay.
So it's a beautiful countryside and. Nowadays, not too many Christmas trees around anymore, but still a nice, relaxing area for tourism.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. That's one of our tours we have met with in our holidays through the Sauerland for 1.5 weeks, and it's so relaxing there. Yes.
Yeah. Sounds gorgeous.
Yeah. You have to learn Dutch if you come over here because it's a preferred victim. For people from the Netherlands going for skiing in the wintertime.
Yes, it's a saying we have here, the highest mountains of the Netherlands people is the Kale Asten, which is 800 meters high, and in Germany. Because it's very, very, very crowdy on the weekends when snow is fallen in the winter and the lifts are open and so on. Yes, a lot of colleagues people from the Netherlands coming to your side to have their she experience. Yeah. I remember. Yes. We know us, I will say almost 15 years, I think. That's one of the same time you started at Fraunhofer where I started here at Gerstl. And I think we have made a few projects together in the past. I remember a story you told me, but I never heard them in a long version from a schnapps from an alcohol which is made in China. Which experience do you have with the Mao Tai schnapps?
Yeah, well, it is like Fraunhofer, as you might know, is not a single company. It's a cluster. We are Europe's largest organization in applied science. Basically, the story behind is 30,000 people and 76 institutes all over Germany. And of course, there are some spin-offs, so to say, where this on a European basis, that there are some institutes going to other country in Europe. We have representative offices as well, and one of them is in Beijing, in China. And at that point of time, so about 10 years ago, there was a lot of discussion, food quality, food safety in China, as you might remember. Mm-hmm. So that was a good starting point to go to China. What you need, of course, and that's something I highly appreciate. That's really great to be with Fraunhofer. You have this representative office over there. Yeah, you can go there and these people are a native speaker. So that makes things a little bit easier. And so that was the starting point to be in Beijing. And then we cooperated with different academies, universities all over China. Mm-hmm. And we worked in different fields of interest, whether it's contaminants, aroma components. And as we worked with green tea in one of the southern regions of China, they asked us whether we would be interested to go to this Moutai city. Moutai itself, we never been in contact with them. The story behind is if you Google this phrase, you will you can investigate that this is world richest in terms of money, the company with the highest income per year. And when you talk about alcohol, mm-hmm. so it's a 350 billion euro business per year, and nobody knows about this. So that's again a great example for Chinese economy. Everybody is somehow aware of this beverage in China. It is some kind of thing which is some kind of official drink. It's special fermented. It's sorghum, it's wheat, and sometimes it's rice. So different recipes. Mm-hmm. And Moutai is only one brand. And the overall wording is I think Baijiu. Baijiu is Chinese for white alcohol. So it's like what we have in German, like corn or Doppelkorn or whatever, vodka. But it has a higher alcohol content, so up to 50-60%. And Moutai is really the premium brand, and they have also different stories and different types of age for these liquors, like we know it from single malt or something like this. So some kind of same philosophy behind storytelling. And in this city, which is really Moutai City, so the name the same, there are a lot of other distilleries. And one also quite large asked us whether we have some solution for quality control. As you might know, this is fermented by experience, not by quality assurance. So then it's very important to control quality, and also there's of course competition. Number one is clear, but number two to 1,000 is not clear. What is the second best and third best, and so on. Mm-hmm. And of course, then you get into food fraud and all these other things beside food quality. So that's the story behind.
So, just a small question about that. Which kind of parameters are they searching for or have searched for?
Yeah. Of course, within this beverage class, it's always important taste and smell.
Okay.
So it's sensory's quite obvious. Obvious. This is what I got this background in flavor chemistry. So it was for me quite obvious that this is the one. Once you have this drink, you have nasal or retronasal perception. That's all about drinking, besides mm-hmm. the side effect of alcohol, of course. But you have to perceive this, and then you can also change from sensory perception to GC perception, so to say. And that's what we had in mind when our colleague from Fraunhofer China said we have an appointment in Moutai City. So we went there by car with our colleague and the driver and one of our friends from the academy where we cooperated. So five persons in total. And we were invited for lunch. That's when the first hot drink
okay
and the second and the third were served. So you had a small lunch and some first drinks, and then they said, okay, you have to look at the process to get an insight into it. And there's so to say a hole where they put in sorghum, wheat, and some microbiology, and then it's some kind of dry fermentation. Then they use steam water to distill these things. So that's okay. A unique process which is only available in China, very traditional one. For more than 6,000 years, something like this.
Wow.
Of course, 6,000 years.
Of course, yeah.
It's China, yeah. Anyway, and then they have this clay pot vessel where they, so 100 liters, something like this. And then they said, hey, you have to test the different ages. That was the second period where we were forced to drink.
okay.
Sounded like a long day.
Yeah, it was only 1 hour later. So it was about 1 p.m. And we were in an interesting shape, so to say.
Okay.
And then the tour continued, and after a couple of hours we had finalized to check all these clay pots. Mm-hmm. And then they said, okay, now we do some sensory testing. And then,
which means drinking the last
2 hours.
Okay.
But anyway, they had some kind of sensory lab. Where they said, okay, triangle testing, our product against a competitor product, and then we had to test a series of different these multi like mm-hmm. products so that was also quite interesting. And finally we said, okay, we will check, send us some samples. And we drove back to our hotel, and it was already time for dinner. So we stopped at the restaurant, and of course they were quite happy with our performance. So they said, we have to drink more chai.
Again.
It's really the challenge is really you have this 50-60% of alcohol, and everyone who's involved in flavor chemistry and working and inject this into the GC. What happens then? You have mm-hmm. one single peak because you have 600,000 ppm of ethanol. That's the most challenging thing to evaluate differences mm-hmm. in aging, in terms of different products, perhaps also in food fraud. So let's call it quality assurance. Mm-hmm. The big problem is really a challenge, not a problem. Fraunhofer, we have only challenges, no problems, of course.
Yes, of course.
It's the same as in for Gassler, I assume. That was really the challenge we faced in the very beginning.
Yeah.
It's always been hard in the quality control thing. Did you nail it down to some targets you're trying to monitor and look at? Or, I mean, my experience on the sensory side, GC is really good for telling you what's wrong. It's just hard for it to tell you what's right. How were you able to, what were you able to do?
This is something in history already. So 30 years ago, we had a very good flavor university in the south of Germany, Peter Schiebele, Werner Grosch at that time, and they invented some aroma dilutionists, say. So what they did was just to inject some aroma extract, and then diluted it by 50% and again and again and again. Mm-hmm. So in the end, you have a couple of components which are still available for you by sniffing pot detection. So this collection of components who survived dilution, you put together in their original concentration okay, which you have determined by your aroma extract. So let's say for coffee, for example, you have resolved, let's say, from 850 components, you go down to 50 components. So and then sensory science come into force when you say, okay, let's check. I take one out instead of 50, only 49. And then you say, okay, still coffee. It's still coffee flavor. Mm-hmm. You don't have a sensory difference. You can use specific sensory testing for that one. So, and you go down and down and down. And sometimes you are not successful and you have to say, okay, the one I kicked out has to come back into my mix, into my artificial coffee aroma. So they did it with different foods and beverages and so on. For coffee, for example, they downgraded the coffee flavor from 850 to 30. So that's the combination of GC and sensory science. So that could work out, but we never went to as far as they went with these different foodstuffs. For what they sent, the Chinese people sent different products, just labeled with some Chinese signs, which we were unable to read. And so we had, I think, 10, 12 different distillated samples. And then we just scanned them by a certain method, had a certain amount of peaks, in an average about 30 to 40, but also components which were quite unique for single samples. Some things were in common. So yeah, it was more or less just some database action.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's really cool. I mean, I guess I should say my own experience, like everyone's, color is my thoughts on it. Cause I was doing a lot of off flavor in milk and off flavor in orange juice and other things. So I'm more used to hunting for the weeds instead of the flowers.
Yeah.
So, but the aroma dilution analysis I'd heard of, but I'd either couldn't remember, or more than likely my age, forgot exactly how that worked. So thanks for that. That really helps. It's a definitely a really cool approach to handling, let's call it, positive experiences in flavor science as opposed to the negative ones.
Yeah, it is, of course, time consuming. It really worked for university, for fundamental science. So I guess flavor houses have already done this business a couple of years ago. And if it does not work out, you got still George Clooney to calibrate your product.
There's always that. And I always tell people that if you're doing work in flavor or in aroma, you got to keep your samples down. You know, it takes half an hour to 45 minutes to sit there through one run on an ODP. Yeah, you can't do 10 samples in a day. You'll go crazy.
Yep.
You'll begin to imagine you smell things. So you've got to keep it short.
Yeah,
you've got to get right to it.
That's true. And for another reason, we use ODP from time to time, but we have to be aware of the training. You cannot say, okay, yep, I do it once in a month or something like that. You have to train your people permanently, or you say, okay, it has to be a quite obvious question, because otherwise it won't work out. So that,
yeah,
advantage, yep, disadvantage. Yep.
Yeah. Cool.
That's one of the topics we have often when we talk about when we talk with people about aromas and sniffing them and so on. So they have to be in training, like in sports, you have to be in training to run a half marathon, or you have to be in training to jump over 2 meters and so on. So it does not work out of the scratch. So
yeah,
that's quite normal, and it's even more normal there in the ODP, in the sniffing part. Yes. That's exactly what we hear from other people also. Perfect. Interesting story with Maotai City. I will Google that, and we'll have a look how the city looks like and where it is. So
yeah. Be careful with the drink. It's how to say it in sensory vocabulary. Interesting.
Okay. I will ask.
I mean, getting out of the science, what does it taste like? Just in basic terms. I mean, what do you think it tastes like?
There's some green flavor. It is like fermented beans. It is not very pleasant. I expect that people which are drinking this are used to it. It is not, it's not really fruity, and it's not like and it's not phenolic like you have some single malt. It's not sweet. It has this due to the fermentation of sorghum and wheat, some special aldehydes, some longer chain aldehydes, some cations, no terpenes and stuff like this, which gives you or lactones, which give you some banana flavor. Nothing like this.
Okay, so,
I see.
We have a Chinese colleague here in our office, so I will ask her later on. What's behind that, and how she what's her experience about that? I'm interested in getting her point of view at this point. Yes, great.
I think a lot of these things were not meant to be enjoyed; they were meant to be endured.
Yeah,
you know, like my experience with a lot of different schnapps. Some I'm not going to call them out by name, but there's certain German schnapps that I'm pretty sure people drink it just to brag that they survived it, not that they liked it.
Yep. I think it's a kind of calibration of the mouth and tongue and nose and so on of the people. Because when I remember when I was young, I know that beer was not my preferred beverage, definitely not. But afterwards, yes, now beer, I like beer now, which is a problem, which is not a problem, but which is not the healthiest beverage I have. But on the other side, I'm conditioned to that. So probably they are also conditioned to that in China. Yeah. I'm not sure.
Yeah, they have the 6,000 years. And of course, when communism came to town, you know, this long walk, which they did for 1 year, they came to Mao Tai City, and then so that's the legend. So the Communism Party has a story behind to serve it in any official situation. So they already poisoned some U.S. presidents with this stuff. So sorry for the message. So you have an excuse for Donald Trump pants.
Great.
No, my.
Cool.
Sorry.
Nothing to apologize for, trust me.
Yes, I would like to switch to another topic, which is called Pummel, or in German, as we say, Pummel. That's P-U-M-M-E-L. And I've heard a little bit about that, and I know that is GC related, and that is probably a very unique thing you will do in the future. So what are you working on what topics you are working with a GC called Pummel?
The idea behind is the full phrase is point of view is multi-channel micro GC, and then if you select the letters carefully, you come up with Pummel. It is within Fraunhofer, as we work a lot of industry and also in public project, the expectation is that we are already at a certain technology readiness level to work, so to say, the last mile of our clients together. Mm-hmm. So on the other hand, Fraunhofer is not financed like universities. We have some basic funding for smaller projects in-house at our institute. So if we want to do something in preliminary research on a larger scale, we have some internal funding, and we can apply for that one by answer to calls or to write something down that we apply for a grant within the Fraunhofer community. It is like, in fact, like answering a EU call or some national call, quite competitive. And we received the money together with two other institutes. One is also in the food arena. The other one is in microelectronics. Perhaps you remember the phrase electronic nose was popped up when we were young. So a couple of years ago.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
So this electronic nose more or less was driven by engineer. So no feedback from us from the chemistry side of life. So they just had a sensor and said, okay, now we can detect everything and we can take this small device from the lab really to the challenge we have in the outside world to have some mobile device. So that's the idea behind. Mm-hmm. And this did not work out for most of the applications as we know. So 15 years ago already we started to say, okay, we have to reduce the size of a GC. At that point of time, we still had the challenge to use a more or less normal column for separation mm-hmm. issues.
Yep.
Now, microelectronics developed quite massive in the last 15 years. So now the idea is really to have a miniaturized multi-channel column, which is the size of a credit card or even smaller.
Wow.
So the challenge now will be, and that's something which is quite unique within Fraunhofer, as we work in an interdisciplinary team. So we have people from microelectronics on the one hand. On the other hand, we have some experts in for sensors in terms of detection. We have some expertise in the injector. In extraction. From our side, we do the benchmarking. So, because what we have seen in the electronic news community is that they measure something, use some statistics, and then they write a publication. And then yeah. it gets into the news. And all of a sudden, you can evaluate coffee flavor by electronic nose. Or you can differentiate between some French wine and some German wine. And in the end, it turned out they just measured with high-end equipment or very expensive equipment the content of alcohol.
okay.
Yeah, I had a similar experience with that.
True. You get some gas sensor, yeah, some metal oxide sensor, semiconductor, and you come along with a hell of ethanol, like again 10-15%. So we talk about 100,000 ppm. Yeah, just these beautiful little flavor components in the PPB range, they have no chance because you do not do any separation work. You just confront the headspace of some red wine to some metal oxide sensor. So what do you expect?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's a very for a chemist, not for an engineer. Yeah.
Yes, that's a very similar
topic. We
had the
same experience in the early 2000s. Yeah.
Yes,
I hear you.
And if you listen to the last episode we have done with Kevin McNamara from the Irish Distillers, he told us almost the same. So 99% of the whiskey is water and ethanol, and the rest is the important part. That's the important thing. And if you would like to listen to that, listen to our last episode with Kevin and get some information about whiskey also. So, but now we are coming back to your micro GC. Sorry.
So I'm just curious, Mark. Mm-hmm. So you're making these really micro GCs the size of a credit card. This is a great question for a flavor fragrance person. So which phase of those columns are you using? 1% phenol? Are you going to go with the wax? So what's the deal?
That's something. We will start with the project actually tomorrow. It will be the 1st of March and the project will run for the 3 years. So in the first year, we will try to answer your question. It is something which is on our side, on our homework at our institute, really to advise people what kind of polymer we use. And we really have to do our homework. It is first instance, I would guess that we look to normal candidates, which we know from GC coatings, GC column coatings, non-polar, semi-polar, polar. currently. It also depends on the target, I think. And that's something where we will start in terms of foot throughout. We will check olive oils, which is quite challenging. Mm-hmm. We will start mm-hmm. with some easygoing experiments. And then, it is not necessarily, as we learned in off-flavor science, that you really go for the off-flavor. But if you don't find the, or if you cannot detect in a proper way your off-flavor, you look for other components with which are joining this off-flavor without any importance. That's what we did with Bortane, for example.
Yeah, that's a great point, too. I mean, it's a challenge. One of the things we do, I wouldn't go as far as to say that we lie to people on the on the sample introduction side, but we certainly exaggerate. We like to say, hey, we've got this wonderful thing that can put anything into a GZ. We can do the full range of everything, whatever that word full range might mean. We just forget to tell you that there's no column for the full range. That doesn't actually exist.
Yeah. And that's really, I think that the huge advantage of Fraunhofer to have these people from the engineering side, from microelectronics, as well as from chemistry and trace analysis. So that's something where we expect to have a certain amount of success, because it is in our Fraunhofer family, they expect some success in terms of upcoming projects with these devices, because, and otherwise they will have some serious talks with us.
Of course.
Yeah, you don't have this talk with the European Union if you go for public projects and you are not successful. You can argue, we need some extra money for the next project, and they say, okay, we see your point. Here's your extra money. So that's not the point within Fraunhofer. We got some more realistic education in this term. If we receive money, we have to have a certain success, whatever that means.
Yeah. It's a little bit like a company, a little bit more like a company than a pure university.
Yes, sir.
Yep. Is that the right wording for that?
Yep. That's a good one.
Yep. Okay. Yeah. Interesting. When did you expect to have a product which can be used in the analytical world? Have you an idea?
We expect that we need these 3 years really to do our homework in terms of identifying and having. We go for only two examples. Mm-hmm. Then it's really a matter of whether these two examples have an industrial follow-up, or we have to say, okay, here, look, we did some olive oil action, and someone from public or industry says, we got another challenge for you guys. And then we need more time to adapt.
Yep.
Or they say, okay, this is already you have shown, and we want to get at least to TRL 5 to 6. So the demonstrator should work in the surrounding of the future application. Mm-hmm. That's the definition.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's what we want to achieve, what we have promised to achieve, and time will show. But I'm quite confident.
Yeah. Challenging. Great. I'm in the glad situation that I'm very close to you and also to our colleagues. So I will hopefully get some information, and probably we can share that at some time here also. So that's, I'm very interested in. Great. Yes. That's one of the cute things we have here. You mentioned the news already, that there was something in the news. In these days, in our German news, there is the new, how should we call that? A new contamination of the months, I will say, is coming through the news, or I don't know how to say that. But the group of the PFAS is really, really coming in the common mind and in the television and in the radio. On every day, you get some new article or new information about PFAS. And You worked for PFAS much longer than the last few days, I think.
Yeah. So at Fraunhofer, at our institute, we started in 1995. So at that point, I was not at the institute. But then when I joined Fraunhofer in 2005, there was some scandal over here in Sauerland, where...
I remember that also.
Yeah. Some Belgian company sold other farmers over here some organic fertilizer, and it turned out it was paper sludge contaminated with PFAS. So PFAS is the shortcut for poly and perfluorinated alkyl substances, and they are water repellents. And we know this ourselves. We know this from our outdoor clothing and some other stuff. But it's also an industrial chemical, which you use for galvanic action, where you are firefighting foams and so on. So it has more than 200 different applications. So it's not like in the news that it's only some coating, some Gore-Tex.
It's everywhere.
It's used everywhere.
Yes.
Because of it's in principle, from a technical point of view, it's good stuff. But it is, nobody cared about the toxic effects to the environment, to animals, and to humans as well. So there have been some scandals in the early 2000s. There was some awareness in the late 1990s also. I have no clue why it pops up now. It pops up now and then, but obviously now we have let's say in chromatography terms, a high peak of awareness. because there is this cooperation, different television stations and so on. They joined forces, and of course there is now this discussion on a European level to ban the substances, and of course this this might be the reason why it now pops up. But as I said, we work now for an analytical way for the last 30 years nearly over these substances.
Kurt, your turn.
Sorry about that, Jan. You know, that would really hurt if they banned it. I mean, you have to ban Teflon. I mean, that would be that would hurt. Teflon used so many places. I mean, of course, we've found this out the hard way with the in-loop instrumentation removing Teflon. But we had this situation where we did some air sampling for PFAS, and we did an air blank in an office, and we thought we had nothing, and we had a hit on one compound, and there were Teflon objects in that room. And the question immediately was, well, was it in the air, or did you just sample? Did you sample some pieces of stuff that was in the office? So. Yeah, the Teflon, which is a source and a sink, is going to end up being a concern for this, both in GC as it was in LC. But getting rid of it, it's a challenge. I mean, we've gone through some of that on our end, but getting rid of it, just in the LL consultation, is a challenge. Getting it out of your home or office is going to be worse.
Yeah, sure. Well, what if we look to our we also established this method. You have precursors, volatile precursors, because the real PFAS are non-volatiles, so which you find back in the application. You have got precursors, you got production side products, and you, of course, the real PFAS, they can also go into aerosols, so they can easily absorb to dust and stuff like this. So if you do air sampling, you'll find also some non-volatiles. And I think that's the story behind, if you have a hotspot, that's one action. The other action is really airborne transportation and water transportation. If you look to upstream on stuff like this, that's the reason why we find it back in polar bear. There are curious sample, funny samples, not funny, but very interesting sampling in the Arctic Ocean. Yeah, and you find it back over there. So no, there's no one in the Arctic water.
They've gotten quite paranoid about this and sampling. There's a several states in the U.S., Michigan and Minnesota come to mind, as well as the Department of Defense, came out with this PFAS sampling advice. And they tell you things like, make sure your shirt was washed 6 times before you sample. Don't wear waterproof clothing because it's, well, made out of Teflon. Food packaging. Don't eat any fast food, or don't eat anything, you know, with wrappers, because some of those have PFAS in them. I remember, you know, back in my early days at International Paper, this is 20 years ago, that was right when 3M started to pull PFAS out of anti-grease agents for paper. So they used to put PFAS on pizza boxes. Yep. So it was a great way to keep the grease out of the pizza box. Unfortunately, yep. It lasts forever. It doesn't. You know, there's nothing natural that will eat PFAS and turn it back into HF or CF4 or whatever else. It's just going to be there. Yeah, it's a big challenge.
It's a big challenge. It depends on what kind of literature you look at. We discuss about 4,000 to 10,000 different components.
Yeah,
and if you really look into standard substances which you use as a reference, especially like 13C label, so you can use it as an internal standard, we talk about 100 components which are available, and they are quite expensive. So it's not like a routine analysis from a point of costs on the one hand. On the other hand, as I said, if you look to liquid chromatography, Teflon is nearly everywhere in your machine. So you have to get rid of this different spare parts, replace them, or to do some pre-concentration of your PFAS inside your device. Also some possibility. Nevertheless, you have to check your chemicals, whether they are clean, your sampling material. So there are a lot of pitfalls. So it's not like we can have like in the pesticide community, where we have methods, where you have your commercial labs, where you have your public labs. It's not easy to establish, and yet it's unknown. EFSA now regulated 4 of them. Under discussion is now to ban them, which is then, of course, quite easy. As soon as you detect something, you know, that it's forbidden. So you have... it will be a very interesting time, and to check future developments worldwide. If you look to outdoor clothing, 90% is coming from China. So even if we ban in Europe, do we want to ban 90% of our outdoor clothing?
Yeah, it's tough.
Yeah.
And you know, there's also a perception amongst chemists. So like the consumables for thermal desorption, we use typically for most applications, Teflon ferrules on that, because everyone thought, well, Teflon's, you know, the most inert thing you can get. And ironically, you know, if you went with nylon or Delrin, they're actually cheaper, but everyone's like, well, Teflon's so pure, you know. Well, until you have a government, contractor or customer, I can't mention which one, they ordered thousands of tubes from us and said, we have to have all the ferrules nylon or something besides Teflon. So ironically, this can be done. It's not hard to hunt all this stuff down and replace it. We don't have anything in a sample path, but unlike LC, the GC side, normally nothing passes through Teflon. So, but there are seals and other things in different places that you have to take out, like these ferrules. Yep. So you can take them out, and we are where we can. Certainly the people out there doing the work are asking for it. Because they're really worried about the contamination at low levels from the stuff. So that whole process has begun, and you're going to see the GC world mimic the LC world here shortly and say, hey, we're Teflon free, because you're going to have to be. Otherwise, it's reasonable doubt.
Yeah.
It's a challenge. It's something extra work. It's not a problem. It's a challenge.
Again and again.
Yeah. We got this European Food Safety Authority, and they said there for certain components you are in the nanogram per kilogram body weight per week. Mm-hmm. So if you just look to water, okay, water is not highly contaminated, but it is contaminated. But you have, if you really think in an average 2 to 3 liters per day, and then you have to calculate your PFAS income, yes, so to say.
So
that will be a challenge for us as an analytical chemist or the provider of analytical machines for you guys, really to do sample preparation, which is matching with regulation. So that will be something we have to be aware of. Or if I do not know the toxic effect, I just do some calculations that I say there's one component and the second component. We don't know a third component, but we have our limitations for one or two components. And we take these values and just transfer these values to all the other PFAS candidates. And then we run into trouble with regulation because we are not able to measure in this sensitivity.
That happens a lot. So I'm part of ASTM and ISO. We have a whole group that talks about detection limits. And it's not uncommon that someone says, okay, we're going to set the regulatory limit in the part per quadrillion or something like that. And I get where the toxicologists want to set a number like that. But, you know, even if you concede to a part per quadrillion, it doesn't mean the uncertainty associated with that number. I mean, if you look at like Horowitz's trumpet or some of the other statistical things where you look at uncertainty as a function of detection limit, it the inner lab uncertainty when you get to these low levels is just crazy. And then you mentioned it earlier too, the issues with standards. You have to have a standard to measure it, and getting these standards is expensive. And because unfortunately, due to high demand, it takes forever to get. So you've really got to plan ahead to get all this stuff. It really is a challenge. And then on top of that, they don't behave the way you think they should. We had, we did this experiment. We were doing two different labs. One was doing the classic TO17 air toxic stuff, which goes from like propylene and naphthalene. And the other lab was doing PFAS in air. And we found out, you love this, a six carbon PFAS acid, perfluorohexadecanoic acid, had the same retention time on a 624 column as propylene. One's an acid that weighs 314. The other one is an alkene that weighs 44, I think. No, 42, sorry. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, it's not just that they don't behave the way you think they're going to behave. It's really crazy when you get into this work.
Yeah. What we have observed in liquid chromatography, normally what we have learned at university that we use an internal standard. If we have C8 internal standard, we can also do some C7 action or C9 if it belongs to the family. But what we have seen that we need for each of these homologs, for C4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and so on, for each of them, and we need the appropriate C13 standard. So
yeah, it's got to be carbon 13.
And it has to be not one fits all. You have to have all the standard substances to all your targets, no way out. Because even if you have C8, we did some experiments. I'm not sure whether it was 7 or 9 or whatever, but we had a recovery rate of 300%, of 40%, 50%. So it is not that you can be in the neighborhood 8 instead of 9 or 10. You have to have the corresponding 13C standard substance for PFAS. We're not sure about the other targets, but this is quite unique.
And thank you for that advice. We're writing a fluorotelomer alcohol method in ASTM right now for indoor air. And yeah, I think we were planning on using that. There's like 5 or 6 of them we're interested in, the telomers, but you're right. I think instead of having one internal standard, we're going to have to do them all. It's going to make a lot more sense.
Wellington will be proud of you.
Well, and there's some specialty chemicals company somewhere that's about to make a bunch of money selling carbon 13 labeled fluorotelomer alcohols.
They do. They're happy people. They do an excellent job, but it's also quite expensive.
It, investment opportunity for those of our listeners who happen to have some extra money laying around.
Yeah, synthesize, certain CP funds. So I'm actually, so one of the next steps could be to do some 14C action to check the fate of these components, especially if you're in the polyfluorinated arena. But it's some kind of outlook.
Yep.
We need something for research for the future.
Yes, definitely. But I think there will come enough of these scandals, in quotes. So there were a lot of components we didn't have on our agenda right now. They will come to the news and also to our visibility and also to our analytical skills here. So
yep,
that will come.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, great. So that's a long time the Fraunhofer works on PFAS. So it's really interesting that you're working so long with that. So, awesome. Yes. So we have spoken a lot of about the past and the very, very near future with the micro GC part. But the interesting thing is we talked with you here about some other things also. And what are you doing in the near future? So where can our listeners meet you or can get some information from you or see you on symposiums or whatever you're doing in the next or in the short future or in this year 2023, sorry. So what's coming up for you in the near future?
Well, there are coming back to PFAS and that's the easy bite. There are some conferences where we surely will join, give some lectures as well. And there's the Dioxin in Belgium, as far as I know, in autumn. There will be some of my colleagues of my team will join CTEC, which will be in Dublin this year. So if you want to come along, join CTEC. Having some Guinness, again, some alcohol. I think it's a good place. That's a very good conference, and PFAS increasingly came into the focus of our environmental ecotox colleagues. So that will be something where Fraunhofer is quite active. There will be some food conferences as well this year. So we are also available on demand. So we will see how these things will work out. Anyway, it's good to be back on the floor in real life. I think that's very important, that community comes together again and discuss things. So that's what I enjoyed last year. So perhaps there will be also some spontaneous action depending on on the time we will have, but nonetheless, we also work together with some authorities on a national level in terms of PFAS. So there will be surely also some workshops on their side where we attend and collaborate and give some lectures. Yep.
And shameless plug for ASTM. We're having a workshop on PFAS in air this fall. So in Washington, D.C. So if you want to come over to an ASTM meeting and listen to how everyone's freaked out about how to measure PFAS in air, you're more than welcome to come over and join.
Interesting. Yeah. You know that last year dioxin took place in New Orleans. A lot of PFAS sessions sneaked in, so it was very interesting. So I think dioxin conference is one of the best places to go if you want to learn about PFAS.
Really? Okay. Then thank you for that advice. I hadn't connected to that, so I'll do that now.
Okay. So now the important question is: if some of our listeners would like to have contact to you because you're the person to talk about with, in which case or ever, where can listeners can reach you on the internet or elsewhere? So. You have the room to give your addresses or whatever, wherever you are right now. So that's should be your place now.
Yeah. So if there's interest in our work, of course, you can contact me by email or look to our website, Fraunhofer IME. Also, you can contact me by email. It's mark.boeckinge@ime.fraunhofer.de. And well, if that was too fast, they can also contact you and you are allowed to give my contact later.
And, yes, of course.
And then, of course, also talk to the people and promote the Gastel. So we are quite happy with the Gastel devices. So we forgot completely to mention that a lot of things which we do in our instrumental world with the Chinese beverages, we used some devices from Mülheim.
But this is not the primary intent of this podcast. So the primary intent is definitely the
education. But this was very interesting, and that's something which is really helpful if you have all these things on board to really compare. And what we have learned in the past is that every matrix is quite unique, and you do not have a one-fits-all method, and you need a certain variety on top of your GC or LC. That's something. And it's the same for PFAS, by the way.
Yeah. Yes. Thank and for everybody who really is driving his car or running in the woods with his jogging shoes in the moment and don't have the possibility to write down the email address, we will put that in the show notes here directly in the podcast. So if you have the podcatcher, you can read that directly or contact us as Gerstl. So we provide that or we connect you together. So that would be also an easy way for you and also for us. So we will do that with a smile in our eyes. So that's perfect. Yeah. Thank you, Mark. At this point, I will say thank you, Kurt, and I will shut my mouth now and give you the possibility to say goodbye at your side.
Yeah. Thanks again for having us, Jan, and setting all this up and giving all a chance to talk. And Mark, it was wonderful meeting you and hearing about some of the common frustrations you and I both have. It's been cool.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks. It was my pleasure to talk to you guys. Hope to do this again somewhere.
Somewhere in life, yes, please.
Somewhere over the rainbow.
Over the rainbow.
I remember the Rainbow Bridge conversation.
Yes. Okay, thank you very much, you both, and have a nice day.
Yep. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks.
Have a great day. Bye.